Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to forge a truly personal spiritual life? And how do evangelical Christians cultivate their sense of a lifelong two-way dialogue with God? Adherents to many faith traditions use prayer and sacred texts to broaden their understanding of their religion and deepen their beliefs. My guest today was particularly intrigued by how some evangelical Christians experience their faith as a sort of friendship with God, who not only listens to their prayers, but answers back in what's been described as an unmistakable voice. T.M. Lehrman is a psychological anthropologist and professor in the Department of Anthropology at Stanford University. Her new book is called When God Talks Back, Understanding the American Evangelical Relationship with God. Tanya, welcome to Think.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Let's start by talking about what it means to evangelical Christians to really hear the voice of God, because what they describe is far more intense than just an understanding of God's message that others might experience through prayer or worship or reading sacred text.
Yes, they expect to hear God talk back in their mind. And they look for, they're kind of constantly scanning their awareness, their sense of their body, for signs that God has spoken. I mean, many Christians do some version of this. So many Christians will say that, you know, they hear from God through coincidence. So, you know, you go for a walk, you run into a friend, and you decide that God has told you to develop, you know, a relationship with that person or to talk to them. Or people will say that God speaks to them through the Bible. So, you know, what they mean by that is that they're reading the scripture and a verse kind of leaps out at them, feels like it's alive to them, and they'll conclude that this is God telling them to pay attention to the content of that verse. These folks took that a step farther, and they thought about their mind differently, not as something that was closed off from the world, but actually could contain this, you know, external person, God, interacting with them in it. And that was confusing to many of them at first. But gradually, over time, they developed the sense that they could have a back-and-forth relationship with God through these dialogues where they're using their imagination, but they're not treating the experience of the dialogue as purely imaginary.
So you spent more than 2 years conducting research at the Vineyard Christian Fellowship in Chicago. What kinds of experiences did you participate in there in order to get to know church members and really understand a spiritual practice that, for those who haven't done it, might sound very hard to understand?
Mm-hmm. I did everything. I mean, anthropologists try to the extent that they can to go native.
Mm-hmm.
I went to church services, I went to house group meetings, I went to regional meetings, I participated in national conferences, I moved out to California after a while and repeated a lot of those things with the local church, joined two different prayer circles, spent a year praying pretty seriously under the direction of a spiritual director.
And how do you quantify something, for purposes of conducting solid research, how do you sort of quantify the experiences of the church members that you talk to?
Great question. So it's, you know, part of what you're doing as an anthropologist is looking for what we call redundancy.
Mm-hmm.
So you're looking for the patterns and the kinds of things people report to you. And at one point I actually went through, I had 28 interviews from the Vineyard Church in Chicago, where I'd spent a lot of time, and I went through and I looked for the characteristics of what counted as sort of expertise in prayer, and I knew what that sounded like, and I knew the way people talked about them, and I kind of built this model, and then I compared, I sort of asked the question, do these 28 people, how do they meet or fall short from of this model, mm-hmm. and what might explain that? And so what I actually did was I also gave them a questionnaire, standard psychological questionnaire, that tapped something we call absorption, which is something like the capacity to be caught up in your imagination and to enjoy that experience. And it turned out that the people who were most able to experience what prayer experts should experience, these very vivid experiences with God, a sense that God is talking back, a sense that you really have a dialogue, a sense that you experience thoughts and images in your mind that they're given to you by God, they were more likely to score highly on the absorption scale. Mm-hmm. And their ability to have these experiences was more related to absorption than it was related to the length of time they spent in prayer. Although once you controlled for absorption, the amount of time somebody spent in prayer did predict how vividly they experienced God.
And I think this is fascinating. Ultimately, you concluded that an experience of the voice of God is a sort of skill that requires both talent and also training. Mm-hmm. First of all, what do you mean by talent?
By that, I mean absorption. So mm-hmm. You need to be the kind of person who's comfortable with getting caught up in your imagination. Let me clarify. I'm not making a claim that God is imaginary, but in order to experience God, who is immaterial, you need to use your imagination. This is something that the church fathers knew. It's something very modern to think of the imagination as kind of frivolous and mm-hmm. not real. So that's the first thing. You've got to have a capacity and a kind of comfort with being caught up in your inner world. Second thing, what prayer practice does, this, I mean by this informal prayer practice where you're talking to God rather than reciting the Our Father, that is asking you to attend to your inner experience. It's asking you to use your mind's senses to participate in this conversation. Sometimes people aim to experience the scripture as if they're there and, you know, they can see what Mary's face looks like. They know what it feels like to, you know, be 14-year-old, you know, be young and scared and realize that you're pregnant in an unusual way. That kind of prayer practice is a practice that forces you to attend to your inner experience and to disattend to your external experience. Hmm. And that changes your experience of your mind. So the other empirical piece or quantitative piece that I did, so I ran this big experiment randomizing people into this imagination-rich prayer and lectures from the teaching company on the Gospels, great lectures. And what we found is what people said ethnographically, that the people who did the prayer practice were more likely to report that their mental images felt vivid, that their internal world felt more alive, that they experienced God more as a person, and they also reported more unusual sensory experiences. So, like some of these folks, they experienced God as audibly talking back. It's not very often. It's not. It's different in kind than psychotic experience. Mm-hmm. The other half of my life, I hang out with people with schizophrenia. The people who experience God as talking audibly, they are very, very different. But they do hear sometimes an audible voice. They hear it when you ask people about this. They say they can hear it once, you know, maybe twice. Not a lot of experiences. If what they hear is brief, that's very different from people with psychosis. And what they hear is usually good, although it's pretty startling. So, you know, somebody's driving down the highway, they hear God say, "I will always be with you," from the back of the seat, or from the seat behind them. It's a little freaky.
Mm-hmm.
They pull off to the side of the road. And then they cry with joy.
Yeah. And you actually found that there were some people who were members of these congregations that found the idea of this experience frightening. Those who hadn't had it said, I don't want it. I think I'd be freaked out.
Yes. And so, again, this is this question of proclivity.
Mm-hmm.
You need to, you know, in some sense, religion is about accepting the world as it should be rather than the world that that is.
Yeah.
You need to kind of take seriously the possibility that what you see is not all there is to reality. And that's kind of a challenging proposition. And some people are more comfortable with that than others. Some people are more comfortable with an abstract God than a God who's right here and personal. That's partly a temperamental issue.
When did this phenomenon begin to be a major facet of American evangelical Christianity?
Well, in some sense, it's come and gone over the course of American history. And
mm-hmm.
so historians call these the Great Awakenings. There was, you know, a bump, something like in the early 18th century, then in the late 19th century. And we're now, people talk about a great awakening taking place since 1965. And it looks as if what happened was that as the American radicals were reaching for experience, that reached also changed spiritual experience. So this is, it's the 60s when, you know, the Beatles were finding Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. It's also when the 60s when the hippies turned from LSD to God. And in effect substituted God for LSD. I mean, sometimes there was a kind of, not so much of a substitution, but an addition. But it's one of the great stories of our religious history that's still not so well told, that the kind of the emergence of a style of Christianity that many people think of as right-wing really got its impetus from this left-wing hippie Christian movement.
And it is dependent in some ways on a different understanding of what God is or who God is than existed before. In order to practice this way, one has to see God as a very welcoming, very loving figure, not so much the sort of distant, judging God that has been part of traditions in the past.
Yep. This is what you could call a buyer's market for God. So God, I think you can make the claim that God has not been unconditionally loving before 1965. The God that the people that I knew followed was a God who was really interchangeable with Jesus, a God who's always responsive, always caring, always accepting, a God that might lead you away from sin, but a God in which, you know, sin is really seen not so much as stuff that you do, but as stuff you do that prevents you from knowing God intimately. That's a very, very, I mean, that's not the God of Abraham and Isaac. This is a new vision of God. It's a very helpful version, I think. It presents God as much as a therapist as kind of anything else. I mean, I should say that people are complicated, and they have multi-layered understandings of God, and the people that I knew would also say that God was mighty and distant and majestic and, you know, the creator. But they also, what they really cherish is this much more intimate dimension to the experience of God.
Yeah, in some ways that multidimensional experience makes sense if you go again to the image that so many people have, the sort of father metaphor of God. You can sort of see your dad at work where he's in charge of everything, and then you can know him at home on the couch.
That's right. And it's being comfortable with the intimacy, which is something these folks strive for. And they sometimes talk about working with their God concept so that they... if they're unable to experience God as truly accepting of them, people will say that they may have been church wounded. That's a term that comes up again and again. And they will, some people will say that they didn't have a great relationship with their dad, so it's hard to imagine God as unconditionally loving. And so, you know, you work with people. You work with your house group or your prayer group or even with a Christian therapist. So that your experience of God becomes more broader and warmer.
And let me jump in here. We need to take a quick break. My guest is T.M. Lehrman, psychological anthropologist and professor in the Department of Anthropology at Stanford. Her new book is called When God Talks Back: Understanding the American Evangelical Relationship with God. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Psychological anthropologist T.M. Lehrman is my guest. Her new book is called When God Talks Back, Understanding the American Evangelical Relationship with God. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Tanya, before the break, you were finishing a thought about people who have struggled with the concept of an unconditionally loving Father God.
Yeah, and I was going to say that, you know, one of the things I saw in these churches is that the hardest thing for people to learn is to experience God as unconditionally loving. It's, you know, they work and it's tough, but they can learn to experience God as interacting in their minds. And, that once you're experiencing God as interacting in your minds, you also have a healthy dose of skepticism about whether you're always right that it's God. But you know, people talk about learning to hear God's voice as the way they recognize their mom's voice on the phone. They learn to go for walks with God and to have coffee with God. Some people go for dates with God. They ask God what shampoo to buy, and they're sometimes a little embarrassed by this, but they can learn to do that and feel that it's not just let's pretend.
Well, and talk about that, because these are people who will said to you on numerous occasions, I know this might sound strange to you, but, yes. And there's a sort of a series of tests that people go through to ensure that they are not just giving in to whatever they might want, but to feel that this is something that God is telling them to do.
Right. So you could they talk about that as discernment. And you have these thoughts running through your mind. You're scanning them. You're looking for the possibility that God is responsible for some of these thoughts. And so people would say, well, you should, a thought is a good candidate to be a thought from God if it is different from what you've been thinking about before. So you hear, you have a thought that says go to Kansas, and you weren't thinking about going to Kansas. Well, that should make you wonder whether that's from God. The thought should give you peace. You should feel good when you have that thought. And you should also it should be consonant with God's character. So again, this is not the God of Abraham and Isaac. God does not, the pastor told me that God does not want you to hurt yourself. So if you think God is telling you that, it's actually not God. And people would talk about testing their judgment about whether God had spoken to them against the world. And sometimes what they meant by that is that they would have other people pray for them too and see what images they had got in prayer. And then they'd check to see if those images were consonant. So it's, for example, one young woman was trying to decide whether she should move, she should be moving out of her apartment. Her roommate had left. She couldn't afford the rent. And so from my point of view, it seemed pretty clear what the outcome of her decision should be. But she wasn't sure whether God wanted her to move out, and she thought in her prayer experience he was telling her to stay put. And so she had some of her friends pray and about what God wanted her to do, and then pay attention to that. That's so specific. And then she decided from hearing her friends and hearing her friends' experiences that God wanted her to stay in this apartment. And, the months went by. She didn't get another job. She still stayed.
We have an email here from Michael, who writes that he's an assistant professor of theological studies. And he says, evangelical scholars, especially historians like me, have no clear consensus on what is meant by evangelical or evangelicalism. The kinds of experience described today as evangelical don't reflect a way of experiencing God that's common to all evangelicals, but to modern charismatic evangelicalism. Can you talk about that a little bit, about your definitions?
So this is part of the evangelical world. It's not clear how much of a part that it is. Typically, you define an evangelical as somebody who has a personal relationship or understands themselves as having a personal relationship with Jesus, somebody who believes in the literal or near-literal truth of the Bible, that the Bible is true in all that it affirms, and to some extent, somebody who's willing to share the good news of salvation with others. That group is somewhere between 30% and 40% of the American population, depending how you count. The The folks that I am looking at are more properly called, sorry for this.
That's okay.
More properly called renewalist or charismatic or experientially oriented evangelicals. It's a pretty big group. So in the Pew Foundation, so those folks are the folks who expect that their personal relationship with God should be interactive to mm-hmm. some extent. You know, the Pew Foundation found that over a quarter of all Americans say that they've gotten a direct revelation from God. The Purpose-Driven Life, over 30 million copies sold, arguably the largest hardback seller in American history. You know, Rick Warren doesn't want you to have, he is kind of skeptical about experience, but he wants you to experience God as your best friend.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of these, I will go to churches which sort of officially disavowed an experiential dimension to their worship of God. And yet then I talk to the congregants who would talk about having coffee with God and giggling with God and, you know, going for walks with God. So I think this is a deep part of the American evangelical experience. It's hard to be totally confident about the numbers. The Pew Foundation would tell you it's 23% or more.
We've heard, Tanya, multiple studies that find that people who have a strong faith tend to be happier than those who do not. Did you find that people who were able to do this were happier even than their peers who believed in God but weren't able to feel that they could communicate directly back and forth with God?
You know, I did. So mostly what I do is, as an anthropologist, is I spend time with people. I talk with people. I look for patterns in the way that they describe their world. I look for what we'd call their culture. But I also did this, a degree of kind of empirical or experimental or quantitative work. And one of the correlations in that, you know, I gave people questionnaires, and this is, not all of these folks were evangelical, but a good chunk of them were. I brought people into my office. I gave them questionnaires. I gave them computer exercises. Then I randomized them to different kinds of spiritual disciplines. When they walked in, one of the questionnaires I gave them, it's called the Daily Spiritual Experiences Scale, mm-hmm. has a statement, I feel God's love for me directly. And that's the kind of statement I think you're much more likely to affirm if you're able to do this back-and-forth personal relationship with God thing. Even though it's really hard to really get it, that God loves you unconditionally, I think that sentence captures something that's at the center of this style of spirituality. You know, the quantitative data was pretty clear. Those people, the more you said yes to that question, to that statement, the less lonely you were and the less stressed you were and the more satisfied you were with life.
Is there a sort of social cachet in spiritual communities afforded to those who are able to achieve this kind of relationship?
Yes and no. I mean, on the one hand, absolutely. You know, so people who are what are become called prayer warriors, people who are really good at prayer, and people come to them for prayer, and they see them as, you know, they talk about them that way. I mean, I remember one man talking about a member of the church. He said, oh, it's like God is whispering in her ear all the time. And he said that with some degree of envy. So that's real. And people, in my experience, expected their pastors to have that kind of interactive experience.
Mm-hmm.
The churches, people in Christian churches come from many different styles of temperament and being in the world. And I would say that about a quarter of the people in these churches have a tougher time experiencing God intimately. They know that they should. They know that they should pray more, but they're scared of it, or it doesn't feel quite right, or, you know, they just don't pray.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think that they're looked down on. And people talk about their gifts being appreciated in a different way. The guy that I just mentioned was actually serving, you know, was involved with the church's finances. And people will say, well, you need people who are able to deal with the finances rather than getting lost in prayer. So it's a kind of a complicated relationship.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Martikia in Dallas. Hi, Martikia.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Well, I feel that even in every role and aspect to get, like you was talking about the gentleman with the finances, even when you're in the comfort of your own home, everybody can feel that experience with God when you go into your prayer closet and you pray and you reach that level of maturity in your spirituality to have that personal connection with God. Some people don't ever reach the maturity level to have that spiritual connection with God. They're still babes, and it might take them a long time to get there. It all depends on your spirituality, you know, like your connection. The more you pray and the more you commune with God, the more you suppress your flesh to his spiritual sense of the world, anybody can hear God talk to them and God lead them and the Holy Spirit urge them. Like, some people might not even really realize that it's God dealing with them because they don't understand.
Martikia, thank you so much for your call. And I'm really interested in the term that she used, maturity, and this idea that it's sort of an evolution of one's own spiritual practice in that relationship. Can you talk about whether you heard that a lot, Tanya, from the people that you interviewed?
People did talk about maturity. Let me just, though, begin by saying that on the one hand, I guess I sort of agree that anyone can develop these skills, but I do think that it's tougher for some people than others. Mm-hmm. And it's striking to me that the people who don't develop them, even though the church can be accepting of them, they often feel badly about themselves, and they often feel that they're unloved by God.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, and what I want to contribute to that conversation, is that there's a temperamental story rather than a theological story, that some people have a tougher time allowing themselves to trust their inner experience and to get caught up in their imagination. It is true that people talk about spiritual maturity. In the churches where I spend time, people talked about that more as the way you dealt with God when God shifted from Santa Claus to a more mature relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So they talked about, you know, you first find God and it's like wonderful and he's giving you stuff and you pray for things and everything you pray for, like it really gets delivered. You know, you don't get a car, you get the red car you always wanted. And then that stops happening.
Mm-hmm.
And you stop and they would say that, you know, your job is to turn to God for the relationship rather than for the stuff. And so that's the way I heard people talk about spiritual maturity.
What sort of prayer techniques are recommended to people who want to develop this sense that they can hear God talking to them?
This is technically in the Christian tradition, this is called cataphatic prayer. I think of this as inner sense cultivation, where you're attending to your inner experience, your inner thoughts, and you're using the tools of your inner senses so that you see, you hear, you smell, you feel with your mind's eye. You bring your imagination to bear upon understanding a passage of scripture or understanding a dialogue with God. And you'll see this invocation in the different evangelical prayer manuals. So Richard Foster has one in which he talks about, you know, encouraging the person praying to touch the hem of his garment. So that kind of invitation has been used in the Christian tradition for a long time to help people become more comfortable with the experience of God, with kind of knowing God intimately. There's another style, which is the other side of that technique, and that is a disattending to your thoughts and disattending to the world.
Mm-hmm.
We'd call that apophatic prayer, centering prayer in the Christian tradition. Your listeners might think of it as Zen Buddhism, trying to sort of empty your mind, although that's not quite the fair representation. But what you need to do, I mean, it's given that God is not material, you need to experience God in a different way than you experience the world with your senses. you need to shift the relationship between yourself and your thought in some ways in order to alter the way you attend to your reality.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the phone, we have Chris in Arlington. Hello, Chris.
Hi. Thank you very much for what you're doing. We need this message very badly. That's my feelings on that. When you mentioned the cultural revolution during the 60s, like the Summer of Love and leading to psychedelics, now, I'm of that generation. I told a friend last night that I could have a conversation with the person. In 2 minutes, I know whether they experienced that part of that, the psychedelic experience. I know if they did or if they didn't because of the way that they see the world or perceive things. They have to see tangibility, they have to see it, touch it, feel it. But in truth, the reality of God, our love, is invisible and faith-driven. I'm so excited to hear what you're saying.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for your call. Did you have a question?
Well, okay. No, just a comment, and that's on the imagination. Imagination is childlike. If you don't have the mind of a child, Jesus, I can't quote it literally, but Christ mentions having that ability to be of a childlike mind, to believe and have faith, if that means anything to you.
We're going to go to a break here. We can get a response from Tanya in just a moment. My guest is T.M. Lehrman, psychological anthropologist and professor in the Department of Anthropology at Stanford University. We're talking this hour about her new book, When God Talks Back, Understanding the American Evangelical Relationship with God. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, our number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is psychological anthropologist and professor in the Department of Anthropology at Stanford University, T.M. Lehrman. Her new book is called When God Talks Back, Understanding the American Evangelical Relationship with God. If you'd like to join us, our number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. I don't know, Tanya, if you had anything to say following on Chris's comments before the break.
Sure. I mean, he talked, first of all, about this amazing moment in American history where, I mean, in the early part of the 20th century, conservative Christians broke apart from the world, called themselves fundamentalists because they adhered to the fundamentals of the biblical story, including the miracles and the virgin birth. In the 50s, in the 40s and 50s, some of them decided to go mainstream to see if they could engage with the world. And that's when they joined the hippie Christians. And these were hippies who it's not quite clear how this happened, but across the country, missionaries, often quite conservative, began to reach out to these kids in their ragged bell bottoms and their flowers and their hair, and persuade them to trade LSD for God. And that movement kind of coalesced; those two came together, in a transformative moment in American history. The caller was also commenting about imagination being childlike, and I guess I have a more complicated response. I mean, I do we do embrace the idea that the imagination is childlike, and we like the idea that we should be able to experience our imaginations the way we did as children. And it's certainly the case that many adults sit upon their imaginations in certain ways. I don't think all adults do, and I don't think that the adult imagination is simply the child's imagination, kind of an adult who hasn't grown up. I think the adult imagination is sort of a different and in many ways a richer phenomenon.
So talk about this, Tanya. Certainly there were cases that you wrote about where people would look to someone who was more skilled in hearing God's voice in the ways that you describe for perhaps guidance or for some additional discernment. On the other hand, people are people. And you also saw cases where members of the church would sort of gossip and say, well, you know, Bob thinks this is God's decision, but I think it's just Bob wanting to do what Bob wants to do.
Yes, my favorite example of this was this young woman up at the front of the church, this blissful expression on her face, and she's talking about how God wants to send her to Puerto Vallarta, and she wants people to contribute to help her get down there to do missionary work. And the guy standing next to me leaned over and he said, kind of in this ironic voice, "Boy, God sure wants a lot of work done down in Puerto Vallarta." And it's, so it's, that's part of the story of when you come to experience God in your mind, God becomes a lot more personal and in some sense more unreliable. That's not exactly a word that my Christians would use, but it's they're acutely aware that their experience of God is bound up with what they call their own stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that you might be wrong in understanding what God was saying to you, and that, you know, you needed to be pretty careful.
Let's go back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Tim on the line in Dallas. Hey, Tim.
Hey there. Just a quick comment, just listening to a great conversation. I'm struck by the part of the idea of skill. Skill in learning or attaining the skill to be able to have a more personal relationship with someone's God. I had, as a child, a lot of what you were describing earlier in terms of guilt with not being able to feel that personal connection. Because I had a lot of questions, even as a really young child, and ultimately, just on a personal level, that ended up me being where I am now, and I have been for over 25 years. I'm a non-believer. But, you know, what I'm struck by the idea of this idea of attaining a skill and perhaps the feelings that come along with one's feeling, whether they have that skill or they're able to attain that skill, isn't that really just talking about the idea that there is a logical part of our brain that in some ways some of us need to set aside or suspend our disbelief, if you will, in order to really jump in head first and buy into, and I don't mean to use that phrase in any disparaging way, to buy into the idea of faith as we move forward into being believers or not?
Great question. And the reason I think that this kind of faith has really exploded in the last four decades is because it explicitly demands that you suspend your disbelief. I mean, because, you know, people, I mean, some of these folks, they put out a place setting for God at the dinner. Not every dinner, but, you know, they'll put out a second cup of coffee, and the pastor will say, put out in the morning a real second cup of coffee with God, for God, and sit down and talk to God across the table. You know, you can't see God. And so there's this in-your-faith demand to suspend disbelief that I think is a way of helping people to feel more comfortable with religious beliefs in the face of their own skepticism, in the face of a world in which they know there are smart, reasonable people who don't believe in God. It's a way of kind of kicking the God experience into a kind of a domain of reality that's not the world of tables and chairs and not the world of fiction, but is somehow in between. And so that, and it sort of sets up these very explicit, almost mechanisms to allow yourself to be comfortable in that domain so you experience God as real, but you are allowing yourself to kind of tone down your critical commentary.
How interested, Tanya, were the people you worked with and interviewed as part of this research in your personal beliefs and your personal understanding of what God is or is not?
They were pretty comfortable with an anthropological interloper.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think of myself as a traditional Christian. I felt that I came to see the joy in what they saw. They didn't press me on every occasion about my walk with Jesus. They allowed me to have my own personal experience of whatever I found myself moved by.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Alex in Dallas. Hey, Alex.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
My question centers around a little bit different tradition and a concept that I learned about being brought up in a fairly, you know, just middle-of-the-road Methodist background from, I guess you would say, a meditative tradition from the Far East called a direct perception with the divine, which is one of the purposes, supposedly, of some of the meditative traditions that come from India. And I was wondering if you'd had any experience with that term, because it was a new one to me.
That term in particular, I'm not sure I've heard before, but this kind of apophatic tradition, or centering prayer, or the attempt to experience the divine without going through stuff, but somehow, and the Cloud of Unknowing, this is a 14th century book that's really quite splendid, and it suggests that the best way to experience God is to, in effect, wrap yourself in a black cloud, so you don't use your senses, you don't use your mind, you don't use your thoughts, you think of any thoughts as interfering with your connection with the divine. We know that that's powerful. So we know that both of these prayer techniques, the inner sense cultivation or cataphatic prayer or meditative, contemplative, apophatic prayer, both of those approaches to prayer are powerful. They will bring you intense spiritual experience, if you're lucky, and you want it. They will change the way you experience your mental imagery and your mind. They will make it more likely that you will have unusual experiences, and you are likely to experience those as associated with God. They can be utterly transformative. But the meditative tradition is a lot harder for people than the inner sense cultivation tradition. It's just getting people to sit still for 20 minutes or half an hour and not attend to their thoughts, to the world around them, makes many of us, you know, very restless.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard for folks.
We have an interesting email here from Linda in Dallas, who asks if you can discuss the distance that sometimes grows between people who begin devoting much time to hearing God's voice and people in their lives who continue to experience God in a more traditional way.
Yes, that's a great question. One of the things that I found moving and also a little unnerving is that what's happening for folks in these churches is that they literally get different evidence for reality,
mm-hmm.
or for what is real. They feel God respond. Sometimes they feel God touch them on their shoulder, and they feel it as a real touch. They feel that they are being led in particular directions. Some of them get pretty involved with demons, and their world becomes kind of, awash in the need to pray against these evil forces that they sense. And they can drift pretty far away from the mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sometimes the drift is, I would look on to the drift and sort of appreciate how good somebody felt, how much they felt loved, felt how they felt sort of caught up and held by God, and it's, you know, it's hard to dispute the data that suggests that that's pretty good for your body. Sometimes I looked on and saw people caught up in attention to demons, and that scared me. I thought that they did not look happy. I think that no matter what your ontological perspective, I mean, you can understand why it would be hard for somebody to be paying a lot of attention to demons. And I guess I, through doing this work, I really began to appreciate why there was a kind of ravine between those who are religious and those who are not, that those who are religious really do experience the world quite differently sometimes.
I have to say, and I hope you'll pardon the expression, but it is somewhat miraculous to read this book and see that, I mean, I can see where it would be of great interest both to people who practice this kind of prayer, who feel they hear God talking to them in their lives, and also to people who are not at all religious, perhaps don't believe in God at all, but want to understand the experiences of their neighbors and coworkers who may feel this way.
Oh, great. Well, those are the two audiences I hoped to reach, so I'm glad you saw that.
But you know what I'm saying, because often those two groups don't find too many books in common that they enjoy reading.
Right. And the feelings are so intense. I mean, one of my favorite examples of this was going out to, I was with a group of faculty talking about my project one Saturday evening, and somebody was listening to me intensely in her seat, getting longer and longer and longer.
I'm not sure what's going on with this. Start again. You said you went out on a Saturday night with a group of faculty. We're hearing some strange buzzing, so if you wouldn't mind repeating yourself, sorry.
So, sorry about that. So I was at the dinner with some faculty, and I was explaining my project, and somebody's face was growing longer and longer, and she said, "You mean you talk to these people?" And then the next day, I was in a prayer group for a year, and I told that story to my prayer group, my buddies from prayer group, and one of them said, "God, I hate academics."
Yeah.
It's just very interesting. I think, arguably the most private and personal domain in American life.
T.M. Lehrman is a psychological anthropologist and professor in the Department of Anthropology at Stanford University. Her new book is called When God Talks Back, Understanding the American Evangelical Relationship with God. Tanya, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
I've enjoyed it a lot. Take care.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. If you've got questions, comments, or suggestions, you can send those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.